hands with them and offered them such condolences as good sportsmen accord to those they have vanquished. Bertie turned to Ranald and said, "We did it, Ranald, we did it!" Ranald nodded. Behind the Skitland on his sweater, his heart, like Bertie's, was full. In the following few minutes, while they waited their turn to leave the stadium, another small boy who had been sitting nearby offered to show Bertie and Ranald how to paint a saltire on their faces. This offer was gratefully received, and soon the two friends had the familiar blue flag displayed in grease paint from brow to chin. It was a time of great pride for Bertie. He was at a rugby match with his father and his greatest friend, the loyal Ranald Braveheart McPherson. Scotland had won, and won convincingly. The New Zealand haka, with all its threats and hollow gestures, had met its match in clear-eyed, firm rugby, played with Presbyterian rectitude and according to the principles of the Scottish Enlightenment. They walked all the way back, spurning buses to savour the bonhomie of the dispersing victorious crowd. As they passed Haymarket Station, Bertie muttered something that his father didn't quite hear.
"Did you say something, Bertie?" Stuart inquired.
Bertie looked up at his father and slipped his hand into his.
"I'm very happy," he replied. "That's what I said."
Chapter 60. For What Is Not and Cannot Be. By the time that Stuart arrived back in Scotland Street, along with his two saltire-faced charges, a celebration of Scotland's victory had already begun in Angus Lauder's flat. The sounds of this party, a hubbub of conversation drifting down the common stair, could be heard the moment Stuart opened the front door. This was remarked upon by Bertie.
"Mr. Lauder has friends in, Daddy," he said. "He's probably celebrating the result." "My dad will also be having a party tonight," said Ranald Braveheart McPherson. "He always gets drunk when Scotland wins."
"That's all right, Ranald," said Bertie. "You can stay with us tonight if your dad's too drunk to collect you."
"Thanks, Bertie," said Ranald. "He will be, I think."
As they approached Angus and Domenica's landing, they saw that the front door of the flat was open. Angus, standing in the hall, glimpsed them and came to the doorway.
"Just in time," he said, reaching out to shake Stuart's hand. Then, looking down at Bertie and Ranald, he said, "And who do we have behind these splendid saltires? Young Bertie and young Ranald, I believe. How patriotic you boys look, and how appropriate for such a day as this."
"We were there, Mr. Lauder," said Bertie. "We saw Scotland beat New Zealand."
"Well, you'll remember that for the rest of your lives, boys, largely because the possibility of its recurrence is slight."
He turned to Stuart.
"You're the statistician, Stuart. How would you work out the probability of that?"
Stuart laughed. "I'm taking a rest from statistics, you know."
"Of course," said Angus. "You told me. But look, the party's just beginning. Please come in. I can probably find some iron brew for the boys and a dram for yourself."
Stuart looked at his watch. It was an automatic response, one motivated by anxiety. But then, in a moment of sudden realization, he remembered that he was free. He could go to parties if he wished. He could take Bertie and Ranald with him. He had no need to report to anyone. Nicola would already have put Ulysses to bed and had said that she wasn't proposing to go anywhere. He really was free. He looked down at Bertie.
"Do you boys like that?" he asked.
Bertie nodded vigorously.
"Yes, please."
They followed Angus into the kitchen, where most people seemed to have drifted. There, grouped around the table, perched on the window seat, astride kitchen stools, were the friends and neighbours who made up this charmed circle. Matthew and Elspeth were there. Released from the triplets by the offer of James, their new au pair, to babysit while they went off to the match. They'd brought the Duke of Johannesburg with them, as Matthew had met him at Murrayfield and had suggested that Angus and Domenica wouldn't mind if he came along with them to Scotland Street. There was James Holloway, whom Bertie and Ranald had last seen at Abbotsford, when they had discovered the long-lost spurtle of Mary Queen of Scots. There was Big Lou, by herself, and Pat, with a young man she'd met in the Elephant House, not Bruce. And there, to Stuart's surprise, was Antonia Colley, Domenica's former neighbour, who had been rescued from Stendhal syndrome in Italy, and then looked after by a convent of nuns in Tuscany. And she was with that remarkable nun who'd come back to Scotland with her, Sister Maria Fiore de Fiori di Montagne, whose social success in Edinburgh, Glasgow and Perth had been reported almost monthly in Scottish Field and Edinburgh Life. There was much to talk about. Stuart engaged Antonia in a brief conversation about the new flat she'd bought in Dundonald Street, before Sister Maria Fiore de Fiori di Montagne interrupted with a long description of her recent outing to the Sky Ball. After this, Big Lou took him aside and told him that she had heard about Irene and Aberdeen, and while she was sorry, she thought that he would be just fine. "If you're ever lonely, just give me a ring," she said, with what Stuart thought might be a wink, but he wasn't sure. And suddenly he thought, Big Lou? Sometimes the people for whom we are really destined escape our attention. They may be there in full view, but unnoticed because we take them for granted. And then he thought, no, Big Lou was more of a sister, and he wasn't sure that he was ready for anybody else. Then he noticed a set of eyes upon him, and these were those of Sister Maria Fiore de Fiori di Montagne. No, definitely no. On the other side of the room, Domenica came to where Angus was standing and whispered, "You must read one of your poems, Angus. You always do." James Holloway overheard this. "Yes," he urged. "We would be disappointed if you didn't." Angus hesitated. "Very well," he said at last. Then people, sensing the moment, fell silent, sentences left hanging in the air, heads turning in anticipation towards their host. "This is a poem that I wrote a few months ago," Angus announced. "I wrote it when Domenica and I went to Mull. If you'll allow me, Domenica." Domenica looked at him and smiled. She remembered the poem. It was personal, but they were among friends. She inclined her head in acceptance. Angus glanced at those around him, and then from memory, so that he might look at the woman he loved so much while he recited, he started his poem. "On clouds over Mull," he began, "a love song. White the shifting veils of rain that fall like tears so white and soft upon your cheek, my dear, so soft and wet upon your cheek. And Mull stands guard against the green sea, stands guard against the green sea. And if our hearts will have to weep, as all hearts will, and ours must do, then we shall shed on this soft isle these human tears, like tears of rain that fall so soft upon the land, so gentle in their quiet regret for what is not and cannot be, for what is not and cannot be." He stopped. Nobody spoke. Bertie looked at Ranald Braveheart Macpherson, who was eating a piece of shortbread. Stuart looked out of the window. Cyril looked at his master, thinking thoughts that in their canine profundity none would be able to fathom. Domenica looked at Angus, and he looked back at her. The End. This is Robert Ian McKenzie. We hope you have enjoyed this production of A Time of Love and Tartan, a 44 Scotland Street novel by Alexander McCall Smith. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Google Play, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.